Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. The podcast you're about to view or listen to, it concerns Iran and events in Iran. It's by an Iranian filmmaker, but we recorded it before the current unrest and protests in Iran. So that's why you won't hear any references in the conversation to what is currently roiling that country. Thanks so much. Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join me today. I recently watched a very interesting film from Iran. And it is stimulating and politically relevant and I think a worthy topic of conversation. So I've invited the Bulwark's movie critic, Sunny Bunch, to come and discuss it with me. Sunny, thanks so much for joining me.
Mona, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
So this film is called, well, it's called different things in different languages. I was calling it, it was only an accident. I noticed in the French subtitles, it said a simple accident. It's been translated as it was just an accident. Anyway, it is a movie that depicts modern Iran, but through the eyes of a filmmaker who is basically a dissident, right? He is not allowed to make movies in Iran. Tell us about Jafar Panahi. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing the name.
There, well, if there are any native Persian speakers on this listening to this show, they're going to be very mad at me because I'm going to butcher every name in this podcast. I apologize ahead of time, but it's a really interesting moment in world cinema in Iran. The last 10 to 15 years in particular have seen kind of this explosion of, you could say, dissident cinema. I mean, Jafar Panahi, he makes this film in secret. He is banned from filmmaking in Iran while he is shooting it. He is supposed to be kind of under house arrest. He is not allowed to leave the nation of Iran without permission. But he shoots it in secret. It comes out via France. This is France's, interestingly, selection for the Academy Awards. It should be noted this year. It's their foreign language film selection.
And they have the Cannes Film Festival where it won the most prestigious award.
So this movie debuts at Cannes. Debuts at Cannes and it wins the Palme d'Or, which is the big award there. And after that, there starts to be rumblings in Iran about this guy. What's he doing out there? Why is he saying these things about us? When he was accepting the palm, I wrote it down. He said in his speech, "No one should dare tell us what kind of clothes we should wear, what we should do, what we should not do." And the clothes thing is interesting because, like, you don't really think about that a lot outside of, I don't know, a high school presidential campaign, right? We're going to wear whatever t-shirts we want, like the school administration. But in Iran, if you do not wear the hijab out, if you're a woman who does not wear her hijab out in public, you can be arrested, beaten, whatever. And and this is actually a part of the film. I don't know if you caught this, Mona, while you're watching it, but there's this really interesting moment where one of the characters who is a photographer, maybe we can set up the film here in a second, but one of the characters in this movie is a photographer. She's shooting a wedding party. And while she's shooting the wedding party, she's in kind of a secluded area. It's, walled off. She's nobody can see her except for the bride and groom. And then this other character who comes in, she's not wearing a hijab, she's just doing her job. She's just going around shooting film. When she leaves this area, when she gets in a car, she drives somewhere, she gets out to go into a pharmacy, she has to put on a headscarf. She has to put on a head covering. And it's just this very subtle little reminder about the omnipresence of authoritarian living, about of living under an authoritarian regime, about the constant ways you have to check yourself, ways you have to fit in, etc. That is just, it's just a really nice little touch.
I found that very noticeable. The minute this character is introduced, the photographer, I noticed right away, first of all, she's dressed in like cargo pants and a t-shirt, and she's got a little vest. She looks just like a photographer you would find in the West. She's not, her hair is not covered. So that was notable. I've since watching the film, and then we should really set up what's going on here because it's so interesting. But since watching the film, I've also done a little bit of research into, because we all remember the case of Mahsa Amini. In 2022, there was a young woman who was arrested by the Virtue Police or whatever they call them for not wearing a headscarf. She was killed in police custody. She was only 22 years old. And it led to a huge outpouring of public protests across Iran. And it morphed into not just objections about the dress code in Iran and the religious police, but it also morphed into just anti-regime protests in general. That was in 2022. Thousands of people were arrested. Hundreds were killed. It was a huge deal. But in the 3 years since then, there has been this quiet revolution among women in Iran where they are continuing to push their rights and to defy the regime and show up. And in places like Tehran, it's not any longer unusual to see women without the hijab. And it's like the regime is losing this battle slowly. It's so interesting. Okay, but let's go back to the film itself because the premise here is fascinating. So it starts with a couple and their little daughter in a car driving at night. And the daughter is dancing and she wants, you know, she's happy. She wants her parents to be happy. They hit something. There's an accident. I won't say what it was. The couple then have to stop because the car has broken down. They have to stop at a place to get some help. And somebody thinks he recognizes the driver of the car. And it turns out he thinks that this person might have been the man who tortured him when he was in prison. That is, the driver is the torturer. He believes it could be. And he winds up, through a lot of stratagems, kidnapping this man and with the intention to kill him, but the man or torture him back. And then the man sheds enough doubt on whether it's really him because the victims of torture had been blindfolded the whole time. He sheds doubt on whether he's the actual torturer. And so in a sort of tragic comic sequence, this Iranian man who believes he was, you know, has found his torturer goes through Tehran picking up other people who were also political prisoners at one time or another and asking them if they can identify him. So pick it up from there.
Yeah. Well, I want to highlight two just filmmaking things here real quick, because they're the structure of this introduction by Panahi is very interesting, because there is a very distinct perspective shift about 10 minutes into the film, 5-10 minutes into the film. You start the film in the car with this guy, and he just seems like a normal guy. He's like a dad. You know, he doesn't seem like a regime hardliner, right? His kid is listening to the pop music. Like, she's having fun. The wife is, you know, she says, "Oh, let her listen to the music." And he's like, "Okay, fine, whatever." And there, everybody's having a good time. And then after this, after they hit the thing, I understand why you don't want to say, Mona, but, you know, I feel like we maybe should tell people just to give them the warning. I don't want anyone to... You know, they hit a stray dog. We don't see the stray dog. We hear it though. If you get squeamish about dog violence, I know there's a whole website out there. Does the dog die? We never see the dog. You know, it's Schrodinger's dog. So you're with this family and you're really kind of empathizing with them. They're in their car breaks down. They're in a jam. They've got to go to this spot and get it fixed. And then, like I said, the perspective shifts. It shifts away from this father and mother and daughter to a guy who is working in the shop. He's up in the kind of catwalk area. He's in the upper section. You know, he hears what's going on down there. Somebody's coming in to get their car fixed. And then he hears something else. He hears a very specific and distinctive sound. And this is the other thing that's great about this movie is the sound design. It's one of these movies I kind of wish I had seen in a theater instead of at home with a you know, mediocre sound system. I wish I could have heard how this sounds, because there's a moment toward the end of the film where I think it pays off. But you kind of hear behind this guy, a dragging, shuffling, thumping sound. It's a very distinct noise. It's very, whatever. I'm not going to try and mimic it. But the sound is very distinct, and it causes this guy to stop mid conversation that he is in and listen.
With his mother, wasn't it? He's
talking to his mother
on the
phone. Somebody's getting married. There's conversations about what they're going to do with the van, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And he stops this conversation and he listens. And you see the look on this guy's face. The actor's name is Vahid Mobasari. Again, apologies to all of my Iranian friends out there. It's just a wonderful bit of acting. It's a wonderful bit of sound design, and it's a wonderful bit of narrative trickery, because there's a lesser version of this that just starts in the garage and you pick it up from there. But by giving the audience enough to empathize with the man who is about to be kidnapped and thrown in a hole and almost buried alive, you have doubt with him. Is this the guy who was some infamous torturer in this infamous prison? Like, he just seems like a normal guy. You know, let's actually see what's going on here. And this is what, and then, as you mentioned, the film almost turns into a comedy is the wrong word, but it reminds me a little bit of a Christopher Guest movie, kind of one of those ensemble pseudo-documentary, the mockumentary style, where they're just going up and picking up guys and the people are getting in the van and are like, that's definitely him. I recognize that leg. I recognize that limp.
Wait, can I just interject real quick? Because I found this really interesting. So one of the things, Panahi himself has been in Avin prison. I mean, yes. he has experienced this. So he says he was never tortured. But one of the premises of the film is that all of these people were blindfolded while they were being tortured by maybe this guy or maybe it wasn't this guy, but they were all blindfolded. So how can they identify him? And it's so interesting because you mentioned the sound. So the first person that we are introduced to here, he recognizes that sound that the man's artificial leg made when he walked. But another guy recognizes him by the scars on his legs, which he feels, right? And a third person recognizes him by the smell of his breath. So it's like all of these other senses that the people have had to use, each one a different sense in order to get to this. I found that really interesting.
It is really interesting. I was trying to think of the proper I feel like there's a parable of this somewhere, but the closest I could get to was feeling the different parts of the elephant, but that's not right, because they all think it's something else, not the elephant.
Yes,
like,
that's right.
It's a really nice, again, it's just a really nice touch. As you mentioned, look, Panahi has been in legal trouble with the regime for a long time. You know, we talk about the bravery of artists in the West sometimes, and there are artists who are brave. I'm not going to dispute any of that. You know, people who go to war zones and shoot documentary footage, etc. But I would say that Panahi has made not quite a career out of this, but he has been doing it for his whole career. I mean, he goes, for instance, to the Montreal World Film Festival in 2009. And he is, I think he's the head of the jury, or he's on the jury there. And he convinces the rest of the jurors to wear green headscarves to show solidarity with the Green Revolution in Iran. And he comes back to Iran. He's imprisoned in Evin. I don't think you can call it just Evin prison. It's the notorious Evin prison, for the record. Yeah. It's the notorious Evin prison.
Yeah.
Where he is, he says he is not tortured, but he is, you know, he is surrounded by people who are being tortured, who, you know, who are being abused and imprisoned and kept from their families. He was arrested for trying to make a documentary about the unrest, about the Green Revolution. 2022, you kind of fast forward there, he's arrested again because he was going, he was trying to figure out what happened to another Iranian filmmaker, a guy named Mohammed Rasulov, who we can talk about maybe in a second, just to as further reading for the people out there. But he's made a bunch of good movies, kind of dissident films as well. And he is also under legal threat from the regime. He was sentenced to prison for 8 years. He fled, sentenced to prison for 8 years and sentenced to a whipping. He fled to Germany. These are genuinely brave filmmakers who are shining a light on something that the Iranian regime would very much like to not see out there. And frankly, that the Iranian regime's apparatchiks in the West get very upset at these filmmakers for, you know, we can discuss that maybe, these are brave guys, is what I'm saying. Jafar Banahi, I hope he wins something at the Oscars just so he can get the standing ovation that he deserves from filmmakers for what he's done.
Yeah, I have to completely agree with that, and also just underscore, not only does the filmmaker deserve credit for his courage here, but also every actor who participated, you know, they're all putting themselves at some risk. And it is so interesting. I mean, we have a million films that have been made. It's many, many good ones about repressive regimes, you know, sort of after the fact. You know, we have The Death of Stalin, most recent, you know, very recent movie that came out about Stalin's regime, and there have been so many films, Schindler's List, you name it. But rarely do we get a film smuggled out of an existing repressive regime where you know that this is, first of all, it's really happening right now in real time, and second, that these people are really putting themselves at severe risk to get the truth out. Have you seen all of the ads about new fitness and January back to health ads and all of that? I mean, it's really a fad. And honestly, you should take care of yourself all year long, which is what I do with my skincare routine. That's why I use One Skin. Their formulas are powered by the OS1 peptide, a patented peptide built on longevity science, proven to target aging at the cellular level. It's not about adding extra steps to your routine. It's about swapping in smarter ones. I love the daily moisturizer because it sinks into your skin without leaving it feeling greasy. I have very dry skin, especially in the winter. And I have to use moisturizer, but I don't like that greasy feeling. But the great thing about One Skin is it just blends into your skin immediately, well, within a few seconds. It makes it feel very soft, but not greasy. Known for cult favorite formulas like OS1 Body, OS1 Face, and OS1 Eye, One Skin stands out for their science-first approach to aging. Validated in 4 separate clinical studies, they deliver hydration, barrier strengthening, and visible improvements to the skin with every product. All of OneSkin's products are designed to layer effortlessly and even replace multiple steps in your routine, making long-term skin health simpler and smarter at any age. Also, every formula is certified safe for sensitive skin. They are dermatologist tested and free from over 1,500 irritating ingredients. They were awarded the National Eczema Association Seal of Acceptance. So you get powerful results without irritation or harsh side effects. Born from over 10 years of longevity research, One Skin's OS1 peptide is proven to target the cells that cause the visible signs of aging, helping you unlock your healthiest skin now and as you age. And for a limited time, One Skin is making it even easier to stay consistent with 15% off when you use code Mona Charon at oneskin.co/Mona Charon. That's 15% off with code Mona Charon. After you purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Okay, so there are aspects of this film also that, because you know it's a window into real life in Iran, it's even more interesting. So, for example, even though they believe that this man might be their torturer. These are human beings and they have a lot of complicated feelings and they have arguments among themselves about whether retribution is just and whether they should behave just like the regime, you know? And so those are interesting sort of philosophical arguments that they have as they're driving this van with the guy in the trunk. But there's that. And then there's also just these little fun, somewhat funny, maybe not, but real struck me as realistic glimpses into how daily life runs in Iran. So for example, they wind up taking, well, I don't want to give away too much, but they wind up in a hospital at one point and they have to give a bribe to the doctors and nurses in order to get somebody taken care of. There's another scene with the police and the police are asking for a bribe. And they say, well, I don't have any cash. And the police are like, okay, we'll take credit cards. They've got a little credit card reader.
That really jumped out at me as well. It's interesting, just the petty corruptions that infest the society and I don't look, I have never lived in Iran. I'm not going to sit here and pretend to be an expert on it, but it does feel like the corrupting nature of living under an authoritarian regime does mean that everybody just, you know, kind of takes what they can get when they can get it. There is a kind of I don't know, third world immediacy to it. Like if I don't get what I need now, I'm not going to get it. And, you know, everybody's just looking out for themselves anyway. Which is, you know, again, I think part of the point of these films that guys like Panahi and Rasalov are making are to say there needs to be some sort of solidarity here. We need to stand together against this because if we don't, we're just going to tear ourselves apart while they continue to rule. It's interesting.
So one of the things that's interesting, Sonny, is that, as you mentioned earlier, the filmmaker in this case who has done time in prison is not supposed to be able to travel abroad without the regime's permission. And yet they did give him permission to go to France to accept the Palme d'Or, which is interesting because there's another sort of competing thing that might be at work here, which is the regime kind of gets benefit from being seen to be tolerant toward somebody like this, or, you know, especially if he gets awards, if he gets an Academy Award, whatever. I mean, it's both good and bad for the regime, right? I mean, it doesn't reflect well on them. On the other hand, if they let him accept it, could look a little better. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there are multiple ways to look at this. One of them is the Iranian regime theoretically thinks, okay, we're an open society. We let this guy go out there and he gets his awards. But I think that gets undercut by, you know, sentencing these guys to prison in absentia. Yeah. You know, yeah. when they're gone or sentencing them when they come back. I think it's more likely the response here is that it's a domestic play. It's to say, look at these traitors who are disrespecting us to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
You know, we are the protectors of the great Persian Empire. We are the Iranian rulers, and they are traitors, and you, the people of Iran, should stand with us as we punish them. You know, that plays even yeah. in a time of unrest. That's a great point. You play to the base. You always yes. play to the base.
Yes, yes, yes. That's a great point. And we are the defenders of virtue. And if you had any doubt, look, the corrupt West is giving him awards. That exactly. means he must be. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Exactly. Oh, you see the same sort of thing here at home.
Absolutely,
right?
You do.
It's the, you know, I don't want to compare Donald Trump to the Iranian regime. Again, like filmmakers in America aren't getting arrested. They're not.
No.
It's not the same thing.
Though but it he is trying to get some of them fired, like Jimmy Kimmel. But I mean, you know.
Oh, totally. Hey, yeah. Hey, look, yeah. You're not going to find me defending Donald Trump on a show. But it's the same thing in the sense of like, look at these Hollywood libs out there. They hate you, real America. I am the defender of America. It's the same basic idea. You play to the base.
Yep.
That's how you kind of shore up your bona fides.
It is just amazing how much the Iranian people have had to endure under this regime. So I don't know if you saw this, but in the last few weeks, there have been stories about the water crisis that's afflicting Tehran, which is so severe that now there has been a drought, which people attribute in part to climate change, but other countries have been able to plan for these things and manage them better. Tehran is so out of water that the president of the country or the prime minister has said that they may have to move all like roughly 10 million people out of the city. It's just nuts. And by the way, I was talking about this with my hairdresser who's from Iran the other day. A few weeks ago, actually. And I said to her, because she had mentioned she had been on the phone to her mom who still lives there. And I said, well, did you ask her by any chance about the water crisis? And she said, yes. And I said, well, what's it like? And she said, you know, it's really terrible. I mean, it's rationed and, you know, you people are hoarding water. They're filling up tubs. She said, on the other hand, they don't believe that it's actually a real crisis. Because they think the regime is just doing all this because they don't believe anything the regime says.
Yeah.
That's another huge.
It's crazy. It is interesting. I saw somebody joke. I probably shouldn't joke about these sorts of things. But I saw somebody joke that, you know, maybe if they'd spent more time building desalination plants than, you know, working on a nuclear bomb, they would be.
Yeah.
They could have avoided this. But this is as your friend says, like these are the wages of authoritarian doublethink when you don't know what's real and what's nonsense. It's hard to kind of plan your life.
So as a matter of pure movie making, tell me what you thought. I mean, so one of the things that really grabbed me and made me watch this film was just, I saw a clip where it showed this bride and groom sitting at the, you know, in an open van out in the middle of the desert. And I thought there's a story here that's somewhat, that looks kind of interesting coming from within Iran. But just as a matter of filmmaking, how would you evaluate what he's done? Obviously, he had to do the whole thing in secret. He can't have had a big crew, I can't imagine.
You know, it's just a really gripping piece of storytelling from start to finish. Like I said, there's that perspective switch at the beginning, which then pretty quickly goes into a murder attempt. And you're like, well, what is this?
Yeah.
Why is he trying to kill this guy? And from there, it turns into almost a true crime story. It's almost a kind of a whodunit almost. Like they're trying to solve this case. It just helps that all of the performances are so naturalistic and so, mm-hmm. you know, so real. This is very much in the kind of Iranian neo-realist style. There are no big action set pieces. There are no big, you know, special effects sequences or anything like that. It's just people on the streets and in a van and having conversations with each other and doling out bribes and, you know, and all that sort of thing. But there's also just such a humanity to these characters. The moral question at the heart of the film is not, did this guy do it? Really? That's not the moral question at the heart of the film. The moral question at the heart of the film is, if he did it, then what?
Yes.
If he did it, then what? And that is, and so, you know, the movie kind of starts at this, the movie, I don't want to spoil it because I most people haven't seen it yet. You should watch it. It's on streaming now. I think it's, where did you see it, Mona?
I did see it on VOD? On streaming. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the streaming services.
The movie starts at a point of, this guy is a torturer and I'm going to kill him. And from there, it kind of goes into, okay, is this guy a torturer? We're going to figure that out. But then what the real question that they all have to answer is, okay, if he is the torturer, what does it do to us to take revenge on him?
Yes.
To what is the difference between, do we forgive? Do we try to reconcile? And without, again, without spoiling too much, I think the big question that the film asks and doesn't really answer, I think to its credit, is, can you have reconciliation without punishment? And I don't think it answers that question, because we don't know what the answer is. It's just really well done. There was this debate on Twitter this week about whether or not books are good for help you develop as a person. And like, I, you know, okay, fiction, of course it does, because it helps create a life of the mind outside of yourself. Trying to work through these issues from the perspective of another person, from the perspective of another culture, can only help you better wrestle through the problems in your own life and in your own culture. And I think it's, again, without spoiling anything, without really getting into how the film concludes, I think the final shot is one of the best and also weirdly most chilling things I've seen in a long time.
I 100% agree with that. And I would just say, the only thing I would add to your excellent summation is I would say that one of the lessons that you take away is, first of all, this is a plea not just for whether there can ever be reconciliation among the different factions within Iran, but it's a plea for the truth first. Right? Without the truth, without confronting it and dealing with it, there can never be any kind of resolution. So that's the first part. And I think that really is like what his whole career, as I understand it, is about, is trying to get at the truth. And then the second lesson that at least I took away from it, is that it's so interesting to look at their moral struggles, because they're the same the world over, right? There is no like morality for Iran that's different from the morality of Peru or, you know, Manhattan. I mean, people deal with the same moral struggles. You know, what is the right thing to do here? What is justice? What is right and wrong? Would it be wrong to punish him for what he did to us in the same way that he did it to us? You know, all of those things are just, they really are universal. And I find it really bracing to see it portrayed on film this way.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I do think, again, there are several filmmakers kind of working in this Iranian neo-realist movement right now that folks should check out. I already mentioned Mohammad Rasoulif. Again, apologies. But he had a film out, I think it was last year, called The Seed of the Sacred Fig, which was I believe set during the unrest after the killing of the woman you mentioned earlier.
Mahsa Amini. Again, apologies I'm mispronouncing it.
But that is a movie that, again, kind of focuses very much on the unrest and it does so from a perspective of the protagonist of the film. The main character is a judge in the Iranian courts. He is the one who is kind of sentencing these people to prison and torture and everything else. His daughters are involved in the protests. A gun goes missing. It's just, again, it's really gripping and bracing and occasionally kind of hard to watch. It is also very good. The movie it called to mind most weirdly was The Lives of Others. I mean, Mona, you've seen The Lives
Loved
of Others. It,
it
is a great,
yeah.
It's a great movie about living in a surveillance state.
Yeah.
And what,
and again, but that one was made after East Germany had fallen.
Oh yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Long after.
Yeah. Long after. And it doesn't mean it's not a fantastic movie. It may be one of the greatest films that's ever been made about repressive regimes, but it was, you know, that what sets it apart from this is that these are coming out of the belly of the beast right now.
The other name I wanted to throw out there was Asghar Farhadi, who the most recent film of his I saw was A Hero, which, again, A Hero is a really interesting one because it's about media and lies and truth. And again, just really, really interesting. I think folks should check it out. But there, you know, we have these we have people telling these stories out of Iran right now. You can watch them. You don't, they're not even books. You don't even have to, it's not even a book. You don't even have to read it. You can watch it on your TV. And they're all incredibly compelling. They're just masterful filmmaking. Again, it's a little different style than I think American audiences are used to. It's a little more in that neorealist tradition. They're sometimes a little slower and a little slower paced, but there are nevertheless, you know, just really interesting, gripping tales of repression and authoritarianism.
Well, Sonny Bunch, thank you so much for joining me to talk about this film and about what's happening with Iranian filmmaking in general. And we will put the other ones that you mentioned in the show notes in case people want to check those out.
Great. Thanks for having me on, Mona.
Thank you. All righty.